blessing. So let's take our Bibles and turn into our scripture for the day. It's Luke chapter 22, and we'll just be looking at two quick verses, verse 25 and 26 of Luke chapter 22. So I invite you to take your Bibles and open them up, regardless of your translation. I'll be using New Revised Standard Version, as I always do, but you follow along. And this is Jesus speaking. He says, "But he said to them, 'The kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, but those in authority over them are called benefactors. But not so with you. Rather, the greatest among you must become like the youngest, and the leader like the one who serves.'" See, this is one of those sayings that reverses everything. You know, I think the thing that's most difficult, the most difficult thing about Jesus, about the good news that Jesus brings, is that what he says and what he does is counterintuitive. Everything he tells us to do seems to be the opposite of what makes sense, just general sense. You know, of what we know to be true, of the way that things work in the real world. It sounds oftentimes, it sounds good in church, right? It sounds good in Sunday school. And parts of it, parts of what he says, if you pick and choose what he says, they'll fit nicely on a poster or a beautiful picture and sold in a Christian bookstore. But take it as a whole. When you take his teaching at a whole, his teaching is out of step with what it means to be great and what it means to be strong and to be successful and in some cases, just to survive. We take what he says and we compare it to what we know, what makes sense in the real world, and it seems out of step. There are some verses that work, right? "I came that you might have life and have it abundantly," or "Come unto me, all you who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest." You know, those we like those, right? And they'll fit on a coffee mug, so it really works great, you know. But instead of fitting them on a coffee mug, if you fit them in with everything else that Jesus is saying, and you realize that the abundant life that he's talking about involves you praying for your enemies and forgiving the person who has done something unforgivable, well, it's a different story. Do you want glory? You have to humble yourself. You want to be first? Then you have to be last. That doesn't make any sense. You want to live? You have to die. That just doesn't make sense, right? And so as a result, let me suggest that we've made being a Christian all about what Jesus did and nothing about what he says that we are to do. And we're to do it with him. And this is most clear when it comes to the decision about what to do, when the decision is between kill or be killed. When Jesus was confronted with that choice, when it came down to a very simple binary choice of two things, between killing his enemies or being killed by them, Jesus chose the latter. And last week we looked at that confrontation, that interchange between Jesus and Pilate in John's gospel, and that most clearly is the time in which Jesus is forced to choose between these two things. And he says, you know, "If my kingdom were like any other kingdom of this world, then my followers would already be fighting to keep me alive. But my kingdom's of a different sort. It's not like the kingdoms of this world. It's unlike any in this world. So my followers don't fight, and neither do I." So Pilate killed him. When the choice came down between kill or be killed, Jesus chose being killed. He chose the cross. And he told us to do the same thing. Put down your swords, pick up your crosses, and follow me. And we're like, that's crazy. That don't make no sense, you know. You can't expect me to do that. I have to protect myself. I have to protect my family, and I have to protect innocent people, if the choice comes down between killing an evil person or being killed by an evil person, then it's not even a choice. It's a moral imperative to protect ourselves and our families and our nation. It's immoral to just let evil win. Let's just win without a fight. Confronted with the choice of kill or be killed, we choose kill. It's what we do. Because it makes sense, right? It's what comes natural. We choose kill, and we pretty much choose it every time. So consequently, we have chosen to believe in Jesus, but not to believe Jesus. Right? And we have crafted a version of the gospel in which all we have to do is believe in Jesus and in what he did, but we don't actually have to believe Jesus. Not in real life anyway. In church, right? In Sunday school, yeah. But not in real life. It's 4th of July coming up, right? And I love our country. I really do. I love being an American. If I had a choice, I'd choose American every time and twice on Sunday, right? I mean, I've been to other countries, and no other country compares. And I'm not just talking about poor countries. You know, you go on a mission trip, you know, Kenya and Mexico and Belize, you know. Poverty is just a way of life there, and who would choose that, you know. But even civilized countries can't compare. I've been to England. It's a great place, and it's a cool place. It's a fabulous. It's full of history and all sorts of old things. It's really cool. But I'll take America over Great Britain any day of the week, right? And Canada is nice. And Canadians are nice people, but it's freezing cold and dark for most of the year, right? I ain't gonna do that. Give me America. I love America. I love freedom of religion and freedom of speech and free press. I love baseball, hot dogs, and apple pie. And I love the irony that we use our hands to play football. I love that, right? You know? The whole rest of the world only uses their feet to play football, and it's boring. I'm sorry. I know there are parents out there, and you've got kids who play soccer, and to you it's the most exciting thing in the world. But if your kid weren't out on that field, you'd agree with me. It's boring. All right. I love the fact that some Americans one day back in the 1860s, they were out playing soccer, you know, football one day. And then one guy just picked the ball up. Right. He used his hands. He picked the ball up and he didn't try to run around anybody. He ran straight into somebody and everybody piled on and everything, you know, and they got up and they're all dirty and bloody. And they looked at each other and said, that was way better, wasn't it? You know, and so they just kept on doing it. Right. So now we have the Super Bowl. They have the World Cup. We have the Super Bowl. I picked the Super Bowl any day. Right. So this week, we're going to celebrate the birth of our country, and we're going to remember those who founded our country and those who were willing to die so that we can enjoy all of these freedoms. And we'll remember all those who were willing to die for our freedom, not just the founders, but all people. Which sounds a lot like what Jesus did, right? He died for our freedom. But it's different. Yeah, I mean, it is. They were willing to fight and die for our freedom. They were willing to die fighting. But that's different than what Jesus did, right? He died for our freedom, but he didn't die fighting. Remember, when the choice came between kill or be killed, he chose be killed. But on the 4th, we won't be celebrating Jesus' version of dying for freedom, and not even in our churches. I have a friend who, one 4th of July weekend, was at a church down south someplace, and they were celebrating the 4th during their worship service. And during the service, they showed a video, you know, a patriotic video and stuff. And he said that the video was full of military images, tanks rolling by and missiles firing and a whole nine yards and stuff. And yeah, it's kind of, I don't know. And what's kind of ironic is that in a lot of these churches, Darwinism is fought tooth and nail, but they're actually embracing Darwin's teaching of survival of the fittest, right? And in fact, we all pretty much have, whether we know it or not. And with good reason, because survival of the fittest works. I mean, and we know what it means to be fit to survive, right? It means having the largest, most sophisticated armed force the world has ever seen, and the will to use it to secure and defend our freedoms, right? Because that's what survival of the fittest means. It means be the lion, not the antelope, right? Isn't that right? Be the lion and not the antelope. Because it's the lion that wins. They're at the top of the food chain, partly because we don't eat lions. We don't like lions. But they're at the top, right? Lions and tigers and bears. Oh, my. And they survive because they're the fittest. They're the strongest. In a dog-eat-dog world, the biggest, meanest dog wins, right? I want to make the case this morning that survival of the fittest does indeed work. It really is true. But that we've misdiagnosed what it means to be the fittest. We've misdiagnosed what it is that makes us the greatest and the strongest nation on the earth. I want to suggest that in a dog-eat-dog world, that we're wrong and Jesus is right. And so since I'm talking about dogs, let's talk about dogs. How many of y'all have dogs? How many dog owners have we got? All right? I got a beagle. And so if there was a fight between your dog and a wild wolf, all right, a wolf, would your dog win or would the wolf win? In the fight between my beagle, Kobe, and the wild wolf, the wolf's going to win 9 out of 9 times, right? I mean, every time the wolf is going to win. Batman, right? Just a little pug thing or whatever, you know. It's like Batman's going to, she's got Batman. The wolf's going to win, right? But even if you've got a German Shepherd or a Pit Bull or a Doberman Pinscher, all right, maybe it makes it a little bit of a fairer fight, but I'm guessing the wolf's going to win most of those fights, right? So, you know. But here's a fact. In the lower 48 states, there are about 5,700 wolves. Up in Alaska, they estimate there's between 7,000 and 12,000 wolves. So that's a total of about 17,000, 18,000 wolves in the United States. There are 78 million dogs in the United States. So you tell me, who's the fittest to survive? The dog, right? Stats tell you. Batman wins because he's Batman, right? You know, Kobe wins. I mean, dogs overwhelmingly are the fittest. Of course, a dog is a wolf, right? You know that, right? All of our dogs, even the beagles and pugs and, you know, your little Yorkie and toy poodles and stuff like that, they're actually wolves, all right? They're all descended from wolves. And you know how that happened? How you went from a wild wolf to, you know, a Yorkie? How did that happen? Well, back when humans were primitive and human society was in the process of moving from being hunter-gatherer to settled agriculture and everything, wolves were plentiful. And some wolves learned that if they followed at a distance, but if they followed these humans around, that they could get some pretty easy pickings. You know, food's scarce, especially in the wintertime. And they found out if they followed these humans, they could eat some of the leftovers, right? When the humans, they'd stay for a few days and they'd pack up and they'd go someplace else. And there'd always be some stuff left behind. And these wolves would be able to come in and get some stuff. And then some of the humans kept some sheep and they kept some cattle. And so some of the wolves could pick off some of them. So these wolves had regular contact with human beings. But from a distance. Wolves by nature are skittish. But some are less skittish than others. Some would come a little bit closer to the human encampment than others. They might sit and wait just outside the ring of light at a campfire, you know, where nobody could see them, but they were there, they were watching. Or they might hide in the woods just out of sight of the humans during the day. And these were the wolves, among all the other wolves, that got the first pickings when the humans moved. They were there first because they were closest, right? They had a regular food source, which meant that they had a higher survival rate than wolves who stayed farther away, the more skittish wolves, right? And so, you know, and especially in the winter when the prey was hard to find. So these less skittish wolves, just a little bit less skittish, but they passed on their less skittishness to succeeding generations of wolves. And some of those less skittish offspring were less skittish than their less skittish brothers and sisters. So they come a little bit closer. And eventually, there were enough generations, there were wolves who were less skittish enough that the humans could see them. You know, they stood right at the edge of the forest where the humans could see them, or maybe they could see their eyes at night. And the humans run them off, right, because they were a threat. But eventually, the humans learned that the wolves, having these wolves out there around them was kind of useful. See? Because, wolves travel in packs, and so they would warn each other if there was a threat, right? If there was a cougar or a bear nearby, they would vocalize and let the rest of the pack know about a cougar or a bear. Well, that also alerted the humans that there was a cougar or a bear close by. So the humans, they found that there was some use having some of these less skittish wolves around the fringes. And then they learned that, well, maybe they ought to have a few more. So maybe they, you know, when they'd leave a few more bones behind than usual, or maybe even throw some bones their way. And if there was enough meat, then maybe they would throw some meat. And the wolves who were right at the edge of the forest, they're the ones who get that meat. And the wolves who were less skittish than the others were the ones who got this meat thrown to them, so more of them would survive and reproduce and pass on their less skittishness to their pups. And on and on and on this went, generation after generation, less skittishness being rewarded, more skittishness not being rewarded. And the humans became, over generations, more and more accepting of their presence. Eventually, humans let them come into their camp. They might take their pups and raise them. And they played with them. An interesting thing that as some of these wolves, as they had more and more human contact, their ears just started to droop a little bit. Which is cute, right? You know, and so, you know, the humans like that. And the ones that let the humans actually touch them survived in even greater numbers than those who didn't. And this cooperative relationship between wolves and humans grew and grew and grew. And these wolves became less and less able to win a fight with a more aggressive yet more skittish wolf, but they didn't need to fight to survive. And eventually, they didn't have to kill to survive. The humans fed them. It was a relationship that worked. So what made them fittest to survive wasn't their ability to fight and kill, but their ability to be cooperative, to be in a good relationship with the humans. And the humans favored those wolves who were like this, who were just, they wagged their tails and they barked. You know that wolves in the wild don't bark? It's a domesticated behavior of the wolves that dogs do. And barking makes for a good watchdog, right? So humans they needed good watchdogs, so they favored those dogs that bark. Wolves don't bark. Domesticated wolves, dogs, they bark. See? See what I'm getting at? It's survival of the friendliest that works. In other words, those who are able to work together and live together in peaceful cooperation with others are the ones who survive. Do the math. 17,000 versus 78 million. It's pretty clear. Survival of the friendliest. Which is pretty much what Jesus taught, isn't it? We are strongest as a nation because we take care of each other. And when we don't is when we are weak. We are strongest when we take care of each other, when we look after each other. Especially when we look after and take care of those who are not able to take care of themselves. We're so great that we'll even take care of those who won't look after themselves. We're great when we take care of the poor. We're great when we take care of the sick and the injured and the not so intelligent. We're great when we let someone say what they feel, even if we are convinced that they are wrong, even if we believe that what they're saying is evil. But we'll protect their right to say it. That's strong. We're strong. Because we look after the common good. Even if it means personal sacrifice. And that sounds like Jesus also, doesn't it? And see, that's the message of the Lord's Supper, right? This sacrificial love. This love that goes so far and says, you know what, in the choice between kill or be killed, I'll be killed. And every time we gather around this table, that's what we celebrate. And it's also what we commit ourselves to that kind of self-sacrificing, looking after the common good, where we're all us's, and we refuse to define the they's, because we're all us's. So let's gather around the table. Survival of the friendliest. I like that, don't you? Let's gather around the Lord's table and celebrate this life and this greatness that we get to share with one another.